latest edition of Serie A Awesome. Inter march on. Milan kind of do. Napoli had an interesting couple of rounds too. For Juve, it was the other way around. They stuttered, then they shone. Zlatan's been in the headline for numerous reasons, and we'll have all this and more coming up. Hello, everyone. Welcome into the latest edition of the pod. We have Mina Rizzucchi, we have Nikki Bandini, Matteo Bonetti, and myself, Kay Murray. And we've got a couple of things to get out of the way before we look back on the double match day that we've had since the last time we were all here in the Serie A Awesome pod. First of all, Juve and Napoli, that's been arranged. That's going to be played on March 17th. The official date was released. The game is scheduled for that date. And interesting is that Lazio and Torino was postponed. Torino were banned from traveling to Rome because they were under a quarantine order from their local health authority. Serie A refused to postpone the game. They insisted that Torino had already used up their bonus with Friday's match against Sassuolo. Another mark on their protocol, perhaps, for dealing with COVID cases, because after what we saw with Napoli's case and their appeal, it does look as though the local authority has the right to overrule the protocol. Anyone got anything to say here on this? I see you nodding, Nikki.
The bonus thing is going to be contested. This is going to get really involved if we talk through all of it, but the bonus thing will get really contested because essentially there is a regulation that was put in at the beginning when Serie A was trying to work out how to handle COVID, which kind of allowed a team once a season, if it had over a certain number of COVID cases confirmed, to say, look, we need an out on this one. We need to take this week and postpone the game. And every season team in theory has like that one get out a year, except that in practice, that isn't what Torino have done. They were told the decision came from the league for their previous game without them making that decision. They didn't make the request. And in this case, they were told not to travel by their health authority, or at least this is the case that will certainly get made to the various appeal boards. Lazio, Claudio Lotito has already said, well, we're going to fight this. We think it should be a 3-0 awarded and we'll fight it if we have to all the way to the Court of Appeals. And yes, unfortunately, what happened with Napoli already has set a precedent that is going to make this really messy, and it's going to go through all sorts of stages before we even get a final answer on it. I think it'll be a minimum of 3 to 4 weeks before we know what the actual verdict is on this, unless the system works much faster than it did, certainly for that Napoli-Juventus game.
Sorry, Nikki, I was just going to ask, we know that there are 8 players out for Torino, but how many are available? Could they have feasibly put out a team at all? Because I keep reading about how many cases they have. I don't understand how many players they have actually available to play the game.
Well, every team should have a squad of 23, which if you take out 8, assuming it's not the goalkeepers, you do have enough under the UEFA regulations to field a team. Of course, I haven't deducted from that any suspensions and injuries they had on top, which have caught me on the spot on. I don't know the answer.
No, I'm sorry, because in my head I'm thinking, because I was very pro the protocol, like everyone agreed to the protocol. So I'm sorry, Lazio had to do without lots of people, Milan has had to do with lots of people. But I know it's a terrible case because it's not one or two in the same way that it was for Napoli, but it was a many. And ASL, their local authority, had already said that it's too difficult at the moment because Torino have too many cases to deal with and we're scared because it's the English variant.
That's a big point. Mina, it's the English variant, but could you imagine the firestorm if there was to be a 3-0 result handed over to Lazio, given the precedent that we saw, which is, in the end, that was a big part of what we were talking about with the Napoli-Juve situation, is what will the precedent be? Will now every team that has a bunch of cases pull something like this or say that they don't want to travel? That ended up not being the case at all. And we're dealing with a once-in-a-lifetime, you'd hope, situation where you'd expect common sense to prevail, even though that hasn't really been the case around the world in many areas. You would think 8 cases, the contagious English variant, more than half the team is probably out for Torino, at least half their starters. Give them a break, like you did with Napoli. This is something that, unfortunately, has not happened often this season. We've seen teams play on with 5-6 cases, but this is Piemonte, the region. We need the ASL, the Olympic Committee, that made the same ruling that overturned the initial 3-0 forfeit and 1-point deduction to Napoli, to come in once again and prevail with common sense that this is a situation that we see a light at the end of the tunnel. Hopefully this is the last terrible outbreak that we see at any club, let them replay the game. I can't believe that it's even up for discussion. This is obviously what should happen.
If it is managed quickly, it's April 7th that they think it will go ahead, the match.
This is the issue. The issue, just to sort of pick up on that from what Matteo said, the issue is, in the first instance, we had the Football Federation gave its verdict and then it got overturned. So now does the Football Federation follow its own initial verdict and send it to the Olympic Committee again? Or do they say, well, precedent was set by a higher court, we follow that? Either way, because Lotito, who's the Lazio president, in case anyone doesn't know that, has said, I plan to appeal this all the way up. I just don't think it's going to get resolved quickly.
All right. On more positive news, Nikki, you have been speaking to Gigi Buffon this week. Tell us a little bit about that chat.
Big timer.
I've been very fortunate to speak to Gigi a few times. He's always a really fascinating interview. He's always someone, with me at least, he's always been incredibly open. And we covered all sorts of interesting bases. We talked about the fact that he told me several times in the past that he was going to retire and still hasn't. He said that 2023 is his maximum bar. And my take of that will always be with a pinch of salt. He also said, look, I might not go past the end of this season. He realizes he's no longer completely in control of that. But he wants to play in the Club World Cup, is what it boils down to. I'll give the listeners a nugget that didn't make it into that interview that I thought about afterwards, because it didn't get into the copy. I asked him if he would go into management like Andrea Pirlo did. And he said, I don't think management's for me, basically. But he said, I could maybe do a national team. He thinks that might be just the right balance of not quite so much day-to-day involvement. And he even threw out this idea, which real Buffon nerds will enjoy, of among the national teams he named Cameroon, which if you're a Buffon nerd, he's idol when he was younger was Thomas Nkono, who was the Cameroon goalkeeper at the 1990 World Cup. And I think he thinks that's a fun idea of maybe going there one day and doing some work together.
It's funny because a lot of managers who go from club football to the national level, their main gripe is we only get to work with these players every 3-4 months. And they just feel like there's this lack of continuity that it's hard to adjust. But if you actually want to have more of that work-life balance, then maybe Buffon's onto something here where you go to the national team, 3-month break, nice little trip across the world, train your players, and then back home.
Also, take all of this with a pinch of salt. Pirlo said he would never try coaching in the Guardians now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny with Buffon, though, and I'll move on in a minute to talk about another figure who's been making all the headlines this week. But I remember when Real Madrid played Juventus, and I travelled with Real Madrid to Juventus to Turin. And we walked past like just a popular outdoor coffee shop, and he was just sat there with his wife and his baby at the time. Very chill. You would have never seen a Real Madrid player in the middle of Madrid in that same situation as him. And anyone who came over, he was like, yeah, hi. Very, very chill, very blasé about it all. So that always stood out for me. All right, let's get to Zlatan, who has been in the headlines for numerous reasons this week. His comments, which we'll get into. His role at Sanremo, which we've been talking about, and also he's injured as well. So let's start with his comments. In an interview with UEFA for Discovery Plus in Sweden, he said it was a mistake and it doesn't look good when LeBron James and other famous people get involved in politics. Now, we don't need to delve too deep into this. We've done it across the board on ESPN FC, but let's get your thoughts on this one. I know it was something you were talking about, Matteo, on a recent show.
Yeah, I thought LeBron's reply was perfect because he mentioned that what he does is so much greater than politics. It's dealing with systemic racism. It's taking care of his people. It's helping underprivileged children in poor communities. It's such an overarching thing that LeBron's mission entails that, yes, there is some politics involved in his message, but it's so much greater than that. And for Zlatan to open his mouth about something he has no idea about, because what Zlatan complained about in the past, and it's something that LeBron mentioned, is how Zlatan feels like he didn't get the credit he deserved in Sweden because his last name wasn't Svensson or Anderson, and because he came from a different country, he came from former Yugoslavia. I believe it was Bosnia where his parents came from, but either way, that his name led to a certain racist connotation in Sweden. So really, Zlatan and LeBron are sort of talking about the same thing, that they're sort of dealing with what they feel is systemic racism across the board. And Zlatan, I feel, lost a ton of respect from a lot of people, a lot of fans really, And I love that the athletes really across the world all came to the support of LeBron and basically told Zlatan, you know, stay in your lane. And in this case, you do stay in your lane because you have no idea what you're talking about and you come off as ignorant, to be honest.
I do feel like Zlatan has had like a bad few weeks in the way that he has come out and sort of represented himself. And it sort of started with obviously seemingly picking on Lukaku, trying to win that mental battle, then getting sent off. It's really, he was asked specifically about the fact that, you know, you have spoken about racism, you have made these comments about your name, about the fact that your Bosnian heritage has come into play. I mean, let's be honest, against Red Star Belgrade, they were calling him a horrendous word, and it was caught on camera and reported by journalists who were there, and he was being called and insulted by fans that shouldn't have been there in the first place. And he responded by saying, it's one thing to speak out about racism, and it's different to have to speak about politics. These aren't things I agree with. I think that you should always try to use your platform, especially if you are as big as Zlatan and certainly as big as LeBron. And I just feel like there was no need to name check LeBron, because I think that what that man's doing, you can disagree or not agree, but you have to give so much respect to him. And it's just not worth really going into it, especially because, as LeBron says, I'm the wrong person to go for. I do my research. I know everything about your history, the history of my people, my platform, and what I want to do with it. So you can't judge people for wanting to do what they want to do. But I do... On the San Remo thing, I'm a little bit annoyed by this because, like, I've got so many people just talking about this. You don't understand. You're not a Milan fan. You know what we're having to go through without this guy. And one second, he came to Milan when they were trying to extend his contract. And he said, listen, I've already agreed to do this festival. What do you guys think about it? Like, you know, I've already signed the deal with Rai. I've already agreed to it. And they said, you know what? Do it. It's fine. Can you still play the football? Yeah, fine. Okay, let's go. Let's extend the contract. We want you with us another year. We want you with us, you know, whenever possible. And he agreed to it. So I just feel like you guys knew about this a long time ago. So I know that it's hard, and I know that he's supposed to, like, I mean, as luck would have it. No, I mean, it's not luck exactly. It's bad luck, but he's injured anyway. But I just feel like at the end of the day, stop insulting him. You can also insult management for having given him the okay to go ahead and do it. They could have said, no, you need to stop that. We're trying to win a title.
If Alexis Salamakers wanted to go to Sanremo, they'd send him back to Belgium, where, honestly, they would put him on the first flight back to Belgium.
Yeah, but
to
Mina's point,
it's special accommodations for certain players. That's what it is.
These double standards have always existed. You think that Neymar doesn't get a double standard at Paris Saint-Germain? You think Ronaldo doesn't get double standards in some situation events? Certain players always will. And in terms of his involvement, I think it's bad in sporting terms for Milan, and I completely understand the frustration of those fans that Mina's mentioning. I'd be mad about it if it was my team and I was looking at them wanting to win a title. But again, I think that what you said there, Mina, is true. Expectations when he signed were not, hey, you are a player we're building the team around who has to drag us to the title. It was, you're this end of his career superstar who has added a little bit of magic, and maybe even some of that magic is the entitlement, the swagger that says to him, yes, I can go and do San Remo. Maybe that's part of what you're buying into when you do that. But either way, the contract was there, so you kind of you have to pay the piper on that one, I'm afraid.
Games it looks like he'll definitely miss. Well, we know he missed the Udinese game. We'll get to that. Hellas Verona coming up, Manchester United, obviously a big miss there, and then Napoli on March 14th. But obviously we won't go into that. We'll go into that on future episodes. What we can do
is still mad. I think Matteo's still mad.
Of course he's still mad.
No, I'm worried about Milan. I really am.
Yeah, you are worried about Milan. So let's get to it, because we've seen two games from them. So we saw a 2-1 win over Roma since we were all last here, and then a very late draw with Udinese. But let's start with the most recent. Was it a point gained or two dropped?
Two dropped based on Udinese just said, you know what, we're not going to try to play football here. We're just going to sit back, everyone behind the ball. We're going to play this super low block, defensive, try to keep a clean sheet, try to gain a point. And when you play against a team like that and you're missing someone like Ibrahimovic, who, right, everyone's deep, you say, okay, we'll play it wide. We'll whip the ball into the box. Ibra can chest it down. He can hold the play and he can invite those runs from the likes of Rebic or Rafa Leao. When you play with Rebic and Leao, who aren't strikers, who are players that naturally drift wide, who aren't players that play with their back to goal, and there's no space in the final third. These are players that work really well when the game is stretched and it's end to end and they can run at someone and there's open space to exploit. When there isn't that, you realize that the very severe limitations of the depth chart of Milan up top, where they don't have another striker. They have a lot of wingers, a lot of attacking midfielders, but they only have one striker, and that guy's nearly 40.
They're missing the other one. They're missing Mandzukic as well.
They didn't have anyone available in this game. Mandzukic that's what I meant. Of course, Mandzukic, but none of them, they weren't available. So in this game, they didn't have any strikers. And I don't know if I trust the depth chart when you have a near 40-year-old who's missing half the games of Milan and Mario Mandzukic, who hadn't played competitive football in a long time and hadn't scored a goal in years.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think I do understand the signing of Mandzukic at the time. I thought it was a great idea. And I think, like, you know, in my head, I'm like, if Ibra's not available, then you'll have Mandzukic. And as luck would have it, when you do play against a team that offers you no space, and I have no judgment on Gotti, I always think that he does what he needs to do. He plays the game that he needs to play to secure the points for his side, and he's done a great job at it. And he was also missing several players. So this was it. It was a defensive game plan. They robbed Milan of any space, and that's what you do when they have Rafael Leao, as you've said, and Rebic. But I also think you missed a player who plays very well with his feet. I think that Brahim Diaz does well, but I would like him to move the ball a little bit quicker. I do think that this would have been a great game for Calhanoglu, because I just felt like that there was this massive disconnect between the back line and then the forward line, and just a mess in the middle. The midfield doesn't provide me with the quality that I feel like it used to. And it is obviously also with the absence of Bennacer, but this is the kind of game that I would have loved to have Tonali, Bennacer and Kessié in it and maybe even Calhanoglu, just in order to provide that quality that overcomes that. Because when you are up against a tight defense, you either need a bully up front, you know, your Ibras, your Mandzukic, you can fight their way through it. And a guy with great feet like your Dybalas, you know, which is what Juventus use him for on this occasion, your Calhanoglus. But they were missing that. So it's kind of like, let's look at Theo Hernandez and hope that somehow we'll get to the front. And yeah, I mean, squad depth is one of the reasons why this isn't a side built to win the title. This is and to face Europa League and do all of this. It's a lot to take with a small squad that has been fighting against obstacles. I think it is time to worry about Milan, because it's many performances that aren't on the level that we were expecting. But at the same time, I think they do have so many absences. So asking them to always fight and overcome all of that and try to find a way through is tough against very physically robust sides like Udinese.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head again there, because to me, in the end, the strength of this team, the thing that was remarkable about this Milan team was its versatility. I feel like there was a podcast earlier this season where I was sort of almost going through it. It's like, well, look, Leao is your pace. Ibrahimovic is your totem. Calhanoglu is your put your foot on the ball in between the midfield and attack. They've got so many different ways of doing it. And unfortunately, like, again, I understand the frustration, Matteo, but Udinese don't owe you a performance. Udinese are there to get the points.
I never said they did. No, what they did is brutally effective. You're absolutely right. They don't owe me anything. They don't owe the viewers anything. The hipsters with the matcha lattes online that want to see free-flowing football. They did what they had to do to take what Milan do well out of the equation.
And it was easy when there's only one thing to worry about, which is pace. If you're worried about just the pace, then that's a much more simple thing to think about than if you're worried about, okay, well, if we sit deep and try to mitigate that pace, then Calhanoglu is going to work in that space or Ibra is going to work in that space. It becomes a much more complicated situation to defend.
You know, I'm going to say something that I haven't said all season long, which is now worrying me. I think that the fourth spot is no longer secure for Milan, because I was not expecting such ordinary performance. Because it's 6 points away now.
You honestly think that they won't make it into the top four?
I think they will, but I'm not sure. And I was convinced. I thought the only question for Milan was, they're probably not going to win the Scudetto. They'll finish second. They'll be 4 points behind Inter. Now Inter can pull ahead to +6 if they beat Parma. We're recording before the Parma game. Milan have put in the most ordinary performances that we have seen in more than 13 months, since before March, when everything stopped. This looks like the Milan that a lot of fans saw throughout the whole 2010s, from 2013 to 2019 that was losing points against teams like Spezia. Spezia's a city, a B-side. Come on,
it's
everyone.
It's not. It's not. I won't hear that.
It is on paper, but it's playing like a mid-table side. I know they're brilliant. I know we all love Vincenzo Italiano. That's great.
But
they got torched by Spezia. That would have never happened last year. They would have never drawn against Udinese. These were the games where they consistently, over the course of a 12-month stretch, put together 3 points. If you took the second half of last season, the first half of this campaign, Milan would have won the Scudetto in any single campaign. But unfortunately, that's not the way football works. And I am genuinely worried because this is now 2 months that we have seen a very ordinary side, and it's only 6 points from fifth place.
Is it that worrying when they beat Roma?
Yeah, but Roma lose against everyone that's in the top six. So this is like something that is like death taxes. Roma lose against top six.
You know what's interesting, though, is they don't actually lose at the Olympico. They don't win against any of the top six, but they haven't lost at the Olympico. And
that was their first home loss of the season.
Yeah, I was shocked to actually see that. That was a really compelling performance by Milan as well. It was a bit of a bonkers game because actually they almost didn't win it when they could have won it by like four if they'd been more efficient in front of goal. Yes. But it is definitely one of those weeks where I feel like the narrative has come full circle in a really tight space of time, because to me that Roma game was, okay, this is what I needed to see from Milan. This is what I haven't seen from Milan in a while. And then straight away you go and play Udinese and it comes unstuck. And look, this is the reality of a football season, and we're all guilty of it when we have a congested schedule and we're on air or writing our columns in quick succession. Sometimes we can be prisoners of the moment. Having said that, the moment is inevitably getting closer and closer to the end. And that's why it's so significant for Inter that, having sat behind the whole time, having had their slips, now they're getting in front. And by the way, even having this conversation, just because of how we're talking about it, I'm half certain they'll lose tonight because it happens by the time we come to air. But it looks a certain way at the moment. And I do agree with you, Matteo. I don't expect Milan to drop out of the top four, because in the end, the teams that need to catch them, I trust less. Mm. But I agree with you that it's not safe anymore. And you start to look at things like, I know we've sort of sung it as a great thing before now, but you look at things like the fact that the starting 11 was 24 years old, just a shade over for that game against Udinese, and you think, this is crunch time. And yeah, are you going to have the nerve for this? And maybe the answer is yes. Maybe the answer is totally. But some of the teams behind them, when I say some of the teams behind them, it's really just Juventus and Atalanta, in essence. I look at and think, I trust your nerve a little more now. And that's remarkable to say that about Atalanta, but we've sort of passed the point of being surprised by that, I think.
Romagnoli was out for the Roma game and then back in for the Udinese game. What can you make of that?
I thought he had a tremendous performance, to be honest. I mean, you know, that goal line clearance. But it's not that this is important to know. I don't think Romagnoli is a bad centre-back. In my head, when you think about what, like, perhaps, you know, the two teams that Milan is in a fight with, if you want, for the top points, which is, you know, Juventus and Inter, that they have something more at the back. You know, they have players like De Vrij that you can always absolutely count on. Skriniar always absolutely count on. Bonucci maybe less, but still a wonderful centre-back. Giorgio Chiellini, Matthias De Ligt. Romagnoli is a step below that. And so you know, sometimes in the big matches or sometimes in extreme moments when you're running at him, when there's a lot of pressure on him and the team is not helping out and it's not compressing the way that it should because of the tactics, because of absences in midfield, they're also playing a role, then that puts a lot of pressure on the back line. And I think that Romagnoli suffers with that. I think on this occasion, he did a very tremendous job. And that's largely also because, you know, Udinese are not really a side that applies a lot of pressure offensively. I mean, they barely had the ball. So, I mean, he came to the rescue, but this isn't a game that I really want to judge him for. But without him again in Tomori and Kjaer against Roma, they were splendid. But just a quick point on Milan, I feel like we have a tendency in the media to do very much hero zero things, you know, where we're always like, wow, this team's amazing. And then they're quickly like, you know, thought of as being ridiculous. But I have been very critical of the way that management has handled them over the last few seasons, over what they've had to go through. But they started a good project finally. They've decided to stick with Stefano Pioli finally. It came too late at the time when they confirmed him, but it's coming together. And it takes patience. And it's a nice young squad. And we can all be happy that it's a young squad. It's because they were so young, they were able to play so many games every 3 days and still manage to fight the obstacles that they were facing. But there comes a time where experience matters. There comes a time when, you know, you do need your Ibrahimovic and you can't keep having to do this without him. And I just feel like, you know, they don't have the experience of winning yet. Things can get a little bit tiring. So we can't expect them to win everything yet. If they make top four, I still think it's a remarkable achievement for how much money they've spent on the squad and for what they've managed to create. And next season, they can build upon that. But at this moment in time, I'm sorry, it's Inter and Juve because they've spent the money. That's why.
I know we have to move on, but just really quickly on Romagnoli, he didn't just suddenly forget how to be a footballer. This is still a solid Serie A defender. If you looked at the memes online, you would think he's now the worst player in Serie A history. This is someone who at his best was on the cusp of the Italian national team. This is someone who in the five seasons he's been at Milan has had basically a new coach every single season, a new defensive partner every single season, who has been always worse than he has until now, where Simon Kjaer has outplayed him in the last campaign. But this doesn't mean that Alessio Romagnoli is now suddenly this, as they say in Italian, bidone, this poor player who doesn't know the game. This is still someone who is a solid top flight player, just going through a very bad period, the worst period in his career. And hopefully he can get out of it because he definitely has the quality to do so.
One player who doesn't have to worry about nasty memes right now is Weston McKennie. His deal has been made permanent with Juventus. They activated their option to make that deal permanent, 18.5 million euros, 5 goals and 2 assists in 31 appearances. Quick mention on him. I don't think anybody expected him to fit in and to stand out just like he did at Juve.
No, and we've talked about it so many times on this pod. No one really expected him to have this arsenal of tools at his disposal where he can lead the line at times, even as an attacking midfielder. He can do the kind of Blaise Matuidi box-to-box role, but he offers more than that. And, you know, he just keeps things simple, but he's been very effective. And in this Juventus midfield that has really not had an identity all season, I feel like McKennie's been one of the first names on the team sheet. And in hindsight, looking back at the original deal that was scheduled with this option of 18.5 million, it's an incredible bargain in this rate. I mean, I think that based on now what we've seen over the course of the season, Juventus, if they wanted, could probably go on and sell him for twice that, even more. So it's a great bargain, not surprising in the least bit.
The only thing that did annoy me was seeing people say hard work pays off. And I'm like, it wasn't just hard work from him. He showed his talent, you know, he's fit into a team, he's shone there. So it's more than hard work from Weston McKennie, and I'm putting that out there.
Thank you, Kay.
Okay, you ready, Mina? This is to you next. Mina can get on her soapbox and her high horse right now because Verona held Juve to a draw, but then Juve bounced back from that draw with a 3-0 win over Spezia, who we've praised on the pod this season. And guess who made a difference? Both Federico Bernardeschi and Alvaro Morata. Over to you, Mina.
When it comes to Bernardeschi, I feel like, you know, I have started to agree with Matteo. I have sort of tried to drop my guilt. I feel so much guilt when it comes to Bernardeschi. I feel like he was so badly treated in the sense that he's just been shuttled into so many different roles. And he's been rather hideous in the black and white stripes, you know, amazing for the national team, amazing for Fiorentina. And finally, we get a performance of the real Bernardeschi, you know, and it was a fantastic performance. But Morata is where I want to focus on because I feel like this player gets overlooked at a lot because he doesn't really have a brand name. And you know, there's a lot of talk about all these great, you know, your Lautaro Martinez, you know, your sort of second strikers. A lot of people talk about all these guys that make the difference. Osimhen and I read about all the time. And I just feel like Morata is almost seen as the guy that, you know, you're just part of your squad, sometimes does it, you know. He was a Champions League group stage top scorer alongside Erling Haaland. Alongside, if we talk about, you know, Lukaku either assists or scores every 80 minutes. Yeah. Ibrahimovic either assists or scores every 82 minutes. Morata's 88 minutes. I mean, he has been so effective when he's played. His absence has been so keenly felt. And it's not because he's the guy who's like, you know, really knows what to do with the ball all the time. But on a tactical level, he actually helps Pirlo play his game because he applies so much pressure up front that he raises the center of gravity. For so long against Spezia, even against Verona, you just felt like Ronaldo was so resigned to this team being so disconnected, no help. He was constantly like, come up, help, because I mean, at the end of the day, they are two, him and Kulusevski are two players that aren't really number nines, and they are being played there. Juventus are missing a striker, somebody who applies that pressure. And I think Morata has learned how to assist, who knows how to score goals. We've always known that, always known how to make a difference in the big matches, you know, in the Champions League for Real Madrid, I did for Juventus. In fact, against Bayern, when he was first with Juventus, Joshua Kimmich called him one of the hardest, in fact, the hardest striker he's ever had to play against, because he doesn't know how to stop him. He has so many weapons in his arsenal, and I think he really fits Pirlo's tactics. Now, what I really want to get into is the abuse that Pirlo is getting. He doesn't understand. This team has no instructions. They don't seem to have a tactical strategy. And I'm not here to absolve him and say to you that this is the world's greatest, you know, coach. But he's played 20 matches. I mean, he's been in charge of 20 matches. And at the end of the day, he is without Giorgio Chiellini, Leonardo Bonucci, Arthur, Cuadrado, Alessandro in the beginning of the season for much of it. Frabotta has become a regular household name, and he's an under 23 player. He has been without Morata. He has been without Dybala. You try to tell me what would happen if any other team has had to play without seven starters in their lineup.
Yeah, but any other team still doesn't have world-class players because you have more depth.
You keep saying that, but there comes a time when you're wondering whether
it's against Verona and Spezia. Like, every team's dealt with injuries this season at some course. Every team has had half their lineup missing. You can't make that excuse, especially not for Juventus, who have that wage to have those players.
Because we've already agreed that this midfield is rubbish. So who are the bench players for your midfield? Because when you're thinking about Fagioli and Dragosin, this is no longer squad depth. This is your under 23 side. So tell me.
Fagioli's actually done well. I think Fagioli should play more. I like Fagioli when he's out there. I don't think Fagioli's like, oh my God, we sent in a kid from the street. Fagioli looks actually pretty competent.
You can't talk about Fagioli and then be like, I can't believe Juventus are not winning all their matches.
But look at who's around him.
You can say they should win over Spezia, but I'm sorry, against Hellas Verona, no.
You have half a billion dollars of players out on the pitch, even if Fagioli's out there. You have Chiesa and Kulusevski and Morata and Ronaldo.
So we have to cry for you when you're without Ibrahimovic and your Calhanoglu.
No, and Milan continue doing well without those players. And Milan have nowhere near the depth of Juventus, and I'm not going to
live.
If you're trying to get
Matteo,
me to go after Pirlo, I'm not going to do it. I feel
where's
bad for him because he was put in a situation that's a lose-lose. Trying to win your 10th consecutive Scudetto, it can only go down from here. If he gets knocked out of the Champions League, it's a failure, even though you need luck in the Champions League. If you don't win the Scudetto for the 10th time in a row, it's a failure because you're expected to. It's almost seen as an oversight. I actually feel bad for Pirlo, and I'm not going to go at him because the people who should be criticized are the ones above.
It is an excuse because to not have Dybala Morata for most of your season is a huge loss to any team.
Dybala wasn't even playing half the games for the last few seasons.
Exactly.
He comes for half a season as the MVP, but the other half
because there's Mandzukic available, there was Higuain available, there was other Douglas Costa available. I'm not here to tell you like, oh yeah, this means that, you know, it's fine if Juventus come six. No, it's a failure if they're out of the Champions League, and it's a failure if they're out of Serie A and not winning it. I absolutely agree with that. I'm just saying to you that you cannot blame Pirlo for not having a tactical strategy when he's missing so many key starters. It doesn't matter against Spezia, you should always win. And they did eventually when they got just two players back into that team. But against Juric and Hellas Verona, I think it becomes a harder sell. Now, all I'm saying to you when it comes to this is don't judge Pirlo. This is a team that has a lot of strength in centre-backs and has a lot of strength in wide players. He's not a terrific coach, but I don't want to make sweeping statements about someone who's only had 20 games in charge. When he has had players available to him, he has managed some impressive performances. He's defeated Barcelona. He won his group in Champions League. He's won the Supercoppa. He's lifted a trophy already. And it weren't against rubbish teams. They were against Napoli. He defeated Inter in the Coppa Italia as well this year. So I don't want to be like, okay, let's jump on this. But I do think there needs to be some sort of, he's missing seven starters. Let's give this guy a break and let's maybe blame management.
But the seven starters thing is complicated because, yes, look, any team missing that many number of players, of course, it's going to suffer something for it. I do think you wouldn't have to look very hard if you went back to September to find a ton of people, I think I remember this happening, like retweeting and holding up Juventus team sheets and going, oh, look, this substitute's benched to win the league. Well, maybe not actually. But I think that part of the issue is not, I mean, to be honest with you, when you're talking about, oh, they're missing Morata, they're missing Dybala, look, I am with you on the Morata importance and his quality. I think that he would be, there's a whole fascinating alternative history to me where he doesn't leave Juventus and go back to Madrid. And I think he would be something so important to Juventus now. I think his identity is with that club, actually, strangely, even though it isn't where he started. But I'm not going to feel like, oh, you haven't got options up front when you have Kulusevski, who we were all raving about at the start of the season, certainly me included, and whose trajectory has kind of gone like that. And that is on Pirlo. That is your responsibility as a manager to keep players moving in the right direction. On the other hand, talking about recruitment, this McKennie deal has really made me think a lot about this. I like Weston McKennie as a player. I think he's a good functional player who's going to fit in that team long term. But the fact that we would be looking around and thinking, gosh, is this the best Juventus midfielder this season? That's a damning indictment nevertheless, because he's not at a Pirlo level. He's not at frankly, a Frank Kessie, Ismael Benacer level when they were playing earlier this season. And the midfield situation is the core of everything for me. I'm not worried about their attack, even when they're missing three players, because they've got enough. If you've got Ronaldo, you've got enough, frankly. But if you have got no one when Arthur is out who you trust to play as a playmaker, that's a disastrous verdict on your putting together of a squad. And that is where this team is, because the midfield in that Verona game, you had Aaron Ramsey, who I've gone to bat for on this show enough times, but frankly is not playing as a midfielder, is somewhere between the midfield and attack, off doing his thing, leaving even more responsibility on the people behind him, pushing forward on that left. And I think this was almost the worst part of it. He's pushing forward on the left. The whole team is pushing forward on the left. You've got Alexandro playing at centre back on the left. And that means your actual most effective attacking player, Federico Chiesa, because I think he is at the moment, on the other side, has to drop back because you've got so much impetus on the left. I think that is partly still on Pirlo, because you have to rebalance your team and see what you have.
And the midfield that hasn't been able to play together, that it's not like these are competition winners that are brought off the street. Like, let's not forget, Rodrigo Bentancur is actually a really good prospect who was supposed to break out this season based on the assist machine that he was in the last campaign. Adrian Rabiot, free transfer, huge wages, someone who started for PSG in a team that was dominating Ligue 1, that was going far into the Champions League. Like, he's not exactly some guy that was like, well, what the heck is he doing here? He still had a name in France, and he was playing around superstars and doing quite well. Not only that, but Arthur was supposed to come in, and I've liked what we saw recently from Arthur before the injuries. I thought he was growing into his own, and he was doing a role that, okay, he's not a regista, he's not a deep-lying playmaker, or maybe that's a problem, that they don't have an authentic deep-lying playmaker like Pirlo. But then it's also the job of whoever's in charge of creating the squad, of realizing, right, we don't have that position, so what can we do? Because clearly Bentancur there, he makes too many mistakes, he needs to be further up the pitch. And that's where you can circle around to Pirlo, and maybe that's where you start seeing some of the lack of experience.
This is what I was trying to explain, in the sense of, you know, I do still, I'm sorry, absences make a point, because if they don't, then why is Messi not alone worth winning everything with Barcelona? You need a squad that's well balanced, yeah? And this is without absences. Even if you include all the best teams, there has been a mistake in management in the way that they have balanced the side. And I think that it needs to be spoken about a little bit more rather than constantly going for Pirlo. But I do think that when you are being forced to play Kulusevski up front, yes, I mean, I'm trying to think of who I would play alongside Ronaldo, because at this moment in time, is it Chiesa? How do I try to find the balance? Because at the end of the day, I don't have another striker. And yet I have four centre-backs of the highest quality, even though there was still only one available to play against Spezia. But, you know, and then weirdly enough, in midfield, I've handed the keys to players like Ramsey and Arthur. If anyone had watched Amazon Prime's All or Nothing on Brazil, you'll know Arthur is injury prone. If you had watched him in Barcelona, you know he's injury prone. Ramsey is injury prone. At least Pjanic and Matuidi. I mean, I've always, you know, talked about Pjanic. I'm not saying to you, I still think he's a good player. It's just I never thought that he was good enough for Juventus. But these guys were always available. Ramsey, I don't know, and Arthur, if they're ever going to be available. Rabiot has a name, but again, not a big one. He was always a complimentary figure in the PSG's midfield. He wasn't included in the World Cup. Deschamps had problems with his attitude. He's had problems with his attitude all over, as well as in Juventus when he didn't come back, when it came to him going away back to France. He's not a player that I think offers very much. This is a team that's missing a guy who knows how to play the ball in midfield. They have Arthur available, and they will only ever have Arthur available for a handful of games. How can you have a whole team that you've spent so much money on relying on one striker, no ball player other than Arthur? It just makes absolutely no sense. And then, you know, all the absences available, and they were like, well, Pirlo just doesn't have a tactical strategy.
Inter. So as we mentioned, at the time of recording, they will be playing later today against Parma, but they do continue to impress. They had a 3-0 win over Genoa. Romelu Lukaku continues to shine. It took him just over 30 seconds to score the opener against Genoa. He also set up the second for Darmian, who was in for the suspended Hakimi, before substitute Alexis Sanchez made it 3. It's hard to say too much, but it would be quite the result if struggling Parma did upset them. But with everyone seemingly stumbling around Inter, Nikki, they have to continue to make this count.
Yeah, I mean, at the time of recording, and frankly, even if they were to lose to Parma, it is Inter's to lose now. That's the situation. And they have the points advantage. They have a big enough points advantage that even if Juventus do win their game in hand, they still look pretty comfy. So don't blow it, is, I think, the position that Inter are in. This was, the Genoa game was a really good win. I think this had the feel of, to me, a classic bananas game, because you've just come off these sort of really big, important, everyone looking at you wins over Lazio and Milan. And you think this is such an easy game to come into and just ease your foot off a tiny bit and come up against a Genoa team that really hadn't been losing under Ballardini, as we've talked about a lot, and things go wrong. So the fact that you don't just win it, but win it emphatically, is certainly encouraging. I think, actually, following along some of the Inter accounts that I follow on socials, I would say there were, even in what felt like a comfortable game for someone a bit more removed to watch, plenty of people still riding that journey of anxiety, because even though they were that good, they were only 1-0 up for quite a long time. And I think there was that fear in the team that maybe they'd blow it. But in the end, they never really gave Genoa much of a sniff. Lukaku, as you mentioned, fantastic. Eriksen is week to week looking more and more like a part of that project. You just got good, mature performances out of everyone in this game. And again, Inter just need to keep doing this till the end of the season. They have a little bit of leeway even already because of results that Milan and Juventus have had recently. So it's theirs to lose, but for all I know, by the time people are listening to this, they've somehow dropped points against Parma, and it's a little bit back, more in the balance again.
So congrats to Romelu Lukaku being voted the February Player of the Month, and me and Nikki had a bit of a laugh on this because it was the absolute worst way to advertise how good a player has been. They could have put number of goals, number of assists, best player on a first-place team in Serie A, best counterattacking striker in the world, top five, number nine, really. Instead, they went with physical efficiency percentage, technical percentage, choice of play, KYZ formulas.
Yeah, they were
no one who covers the game, like we have no life, we cover the game every single day, had any idea what Serie A was talking about. Like, I've never even heard of these statistics existing. Like, honestly, not even Einstein would have been able to look in that and say, what the hell are they talking about with the K efficiency of the choices made? Like, that is not what football is. Football is, I see that guy, the eye test is passed, he is a world-class striker. Show me the goals, show me the place of Inter, show me the assists, that's all I need. What was that, Syria? Come on, give me a break.
It was a wild tweet, but it is a tweet, by the way, in case anyone did miss it. It's a tweet from the Lega Serie A account. I will say it was almost worth it for if you click on that tweet and read some of the replies that come underneath.
Replies were brilliant. Yeah, it was...
As are always the best. Mina, would you like to say anything about Inter this week? You've been very nice about them on previous pods lately.
How about their injury situation, which is non-existent?
Well, that helps. I do like that they are... Well, I mean, I don't know. What would you do if there was no Skriniar, De Vrij? And I mean, we're not going to get into this, Matteo, because you clearly hate Juventus. So what I do want to say is that I thought Damian had a great game. I really want to give him his props because we talk a lot about Ashraf Hakimi, and I do think he's a wonderful backup to have in that side. I thought the team played with a lot of maturity. I wish they wouldn't squander their opportunities because I just feel like these performances would be so much more dominating. I did have a chuckle with myself. I do laugh a lot by myself, especially at night when I scroll through Instagram or whatever it is, and it's Antonio Conte now talking about what tiki-taka football is, or is it direct football, and reply to what I'm saying, and I am the new Pep Guardiola. And then I don't know if you saw Antonio Cassano being like, come on, who are you kidding? You don't think you're Pep Guardiola? on the show.
Have we talked about on this show, because I know I've talked about it to someone, like, the way that Conte's tried to sort of gradually rebrand himself this season as fun. Like,
yeah, you've talked about it on another show because okay.
he's got long hair.
Nikki, fire away. I love it.
He did like a video on the Inter site of like, oh, in my free time, I like to unwind and play pinball. Here I am with my pinball machine. It's just like that. And then like a week later, there was him driving a golf buggy around the Inter training ground. It just felt like there was like a deliberate like,
is this a publicity stunt? Is this his PR team saying, yeah, Antonio, it's time to rebrand your image as like this kind of like tough, mean, always sour guy. And like suddenly he's like this likable. But then you see true colors on the pitch, on the sidelines, where he turns a shade of purple that I've never seen on another human in my life.
Yeah, let's keep our eye open for fun Antonio.
One last thing though. Can we all admit, Nikki and Mina, I want you to admit this as well. Inter have been entertaining in 2021. Like the best version of Inter is wildly entertaining.
Three goals a game.
Fun Conte, the new Pep Guardiola. Here we have it.
It's good.
Yeah,
football.
But also Conte is actually a very entertaining figure when he's winning. Yeah, sometimes because he doesn't do humble very well, but he tries. And I think that, you know, then he speaks very properly afterwards in his press conferences. There's no drama. He says all the right things. Like, it still hurts me. I'm out of the Champions League, and that's what makes us fight. And you're just like, yeah, I'm so on board with this, you know. And then of course, you know, like, but having said that, there's a lot of great coaches who, when they lose, are just horrendous to watch, you know, because they'll just, you know, they'll just get really upset with everything. Pirlo even showed that the other day. But these things that I'm seeing on Instagram, I do think he's very entertaining, but I'm another mature performance. This is something that we want to see, because if you do want to win the title, then this is exactly what we want to see. And at this moment in time, when you've got Lukaku doing what he's doing right now, and a team that can bring in, you know, Alexis Sanchez, who came off and did tremendously well, you know, Perisic having the season of his life, Damian coming in for Ashraf, then you're solid.
We're going to bill it Funte. And what we expect from our listeners is, if you see any Funte-style tweets or moments, we would like you to send them in so that we could talk about it on the pod.
I'm so glad he's in our life. I love that he's in Serie A.
Antonio Funte. All right, Nikki. So you've decided this week, you've written about the Napoli's crazy away game to Sassuolo, which ended 3-3. I'm going to read your tweets to you before I come to you on this. So you said, first of all, okay, so Sassuolo-Napoli has been a lot. You left that tweet on its own, which was perfect. And then you followed it up with, that game went 1-0, 1-1, 2-1, 2-3, 3-3, with a gorgeous disallowed goal and then an own goal to start, shots for both teams off the woodwork, and two penalties scored from the 90th minute onwards. And I'm still not sure that even saves the half of it.
It doesn't. I actually think I might have misremembered. I don't think Napoli did hit the woodwork, but Sassuolo hit it twice. It was just wild. It was like watching a basketball game at times, which, funnily enough, the Roma-Milan game was a bit like that as well. But this was taken up another level because there was just a high press attempt on both teams, but just chaotic defending and passing out from the back. Lorenzo Insigne was in one of his inspired nights. I thought he was fantastic. He was the one who scored the brilliant disallowed goal, but so was Berardi on the other end, who was coming in from the flank, and he had one of the shots off the bar.
And you better not have hugged Gattuso, or Mina will be fuming.
Right. But he didn't hug Gattuso because Napoli, who had been chasing the game for a lot of it, because that goal was disallowed, and then they're the team who's behind, and then behind again. And they finally get their noses in front in the 90th minute on a penalty. And you think, wow, you know, this is the way they've pulled it out. They'd done all of that. Insigne scores the penalty to make it 3-2. And then in the 95th minute, Sassuolo get the penalty and equalise. Insigne, I mean, Gattuso was a scene of his own at this point, throwing his jacket, but Insigne leaves the pitch, kicking a bottle, then kicking an advertising hoarding, and then turning around and saying, piece of bleep team, which I will, I'm not sure where our censorship level is, but I'll leave out the expletive he used. And everyone's looking at it and going, is he calling Sassuolo that? Or is he calling his own team that? Because they've thrown away this situation from which you really, really should have had the points in the bag.
But apparently Gattuso had to calm down the team, which is strange, behind the scenes, where he was the one trying to preach calm, where normally you'd think that they'd get a battering from Gattuso at the second everyone was there in the dressing room. But it felt to me, just seeing that scene, that it was Insigne just upset at his own team more so than Sassuolo, right? That was what the moment would have indicated.
The guys in the stadium were saying that he was, they couldn't figure out whether he was angry with Maximovic, I think, or Bakayoko. So who was it that gave away the penalty?
Well, it's easy to be angry with Maximovic.
Bakayoko kind of made the mistake that set up the move that led to the
exactly.
Because he didn't clear the ball out. But then Manolas, and I mean, this is on Gattuso, who'd sent on both of them. Manolas gives away the penalty. Look, it's a bad foul for Manolas because he doesn't need to do it. The ball's probably going to run out if he just lets it go. But I will say this, it's and I've stuck up for Gattuso a lot. Making a like-for-like change at centre-back in the 85th minute, you're sending on Manolas for Maximovic, not a tactical change, just sending on another centre-back. That's a tough situation to walk into cold when you just don't need to do it. I think that was a really reckless substitution and it bit him really hard.
Napoli... Go on, Mina.
No, I was saying Napoli did this. I was trying to remember who it is that they did that when they had to have a free kick and he brought on two different defenders. And I'm like, why do you keep changing the back line at important moments of the game? And yes, you're right. That is on Gattuso, you know. With Lorenzo Insigne getting mad with his team, look, I understand the frustrations of your side, but this is what I say to you. You're the captain. We shouldn't be sitting there talking about how you beeped at them or how your hug means the world or, you know, you missed the penalty that lost the trophy. So come on, you know, like that's a little bit harsh, right? But I thought this game was so fun as well because in the sense that they both have similar ideologies, right? So they're just running at it, going at it, you know? And that was what was like, you just... I have to say, though, like Lorenzo Insigne's goal that didn't get counted was unbelievable. And I thought Domenico Berardi's performance was wild, you know. Mm. I'm so glad that he's always absent for all the Juventus games. But it was such a, like, I have to say, like, if there's ever a team that is just so, like, wow to watch, it is those two sides going together because there's just so much quality in terms of technique.
And it was so unassuming because it was the early kickoff on Wednesday. It was in this weird time slot, like before all the evening games. And yeah, I can speak for myself. You sort of put it on and I was slightly finishing my dinner at the same time. You're just sort of like not assuming too much of it. And then the more it goes, you're just like, what's happening here? Like, this is madness.
And well, before that, they'd beaten Benevento 2-0. Dries Mertens had scored after his first start in 74 days. Politano scored the other. And then just when Kalidou Koulibaly came back and was fit, he got himself sent off. There are rumours about him going to Bayern. We'll get into that on a later show and some of the transfer
Koulibaly
rumors.
Koulibaly in Upamecano next
season. I know,
season.
Can you imagine? Jeez. I'll just mention it because it was played, nothing too much to be said. Derby della Lanterna, Genoa against Sampdoria finished 1-1. But I'd like to get to Sampdoria's previous opponents in this double round that we've just seen. Atalanta, Gosens is where I'd like to go here. 9 goals in Serie Amazing. A this season, equaling his record of last season in the Italian top flight. He's also netted in 3 games in a row for the first time in the league.
This is one of my favorite subplots of Atalanta, and it's how Gasperini uses the wingbacks, where you think back to when he first took over in 2016, Andrea Conti and Leo Spinazzola were the two wingbacks. Conti nearly scored 10 goals in Serie A. That's why Milan bought him for 25 million euro. He has the wingbacks assisting each other so many times. He had Mela assisting Gosens in the game before, and they always make these runs into the box. So it's like when they attack, the reason why Atalanta looks so deadly is like they overload the final third. They have the two strikers, they have 2 or 3 midfielders, and then the wingbacks push forward as well. So suddenly they have 6 or 7 players inside the box. There's players coming from all different directions and so much technique as well on the ball. It is one of the wrinkles that it's not something we really grew up watching, inverted fullbacks. You always expect them, okay, they get forward a few times, they'll make the overlapping run. No. In this Atalanta system with three center backs, the wingbacks are every bit as much of attackers as anyone else, and they have really thrived. And Gosens now looks like one of the best wingbacks in Europe.
You know what's interesting is that you've got coaches like Stefano Pioli who help develop players because, you know, the way they speak to them or what they tell them to improve in the, within their game, such as, you know, Calabria, for example. And then you've got coaches like Gasperini whose tactics alone just make players have these kind of seasons that are just out of this world. And he does that a lot with the wingbacks. It is by creating space through his tactics, through his triangles, the overlapping, you know, through the in the wide areas that allows these players to really shine and enjoy their football. And I just wonder sometimes, you know, like if I'm ever trying to go and buy a player from Atalanta, will I ever get him to perform to the levels that Gasperini just manages to get everyone to perform, whoever he loses? It's not Zapata, Ilicic, and Papu Gomez. It's I'm going to depend on anyone and they're going to just shine and they're going to be amazing and you're all going to stand back and applaud. It's, and by the way, the energy that they're playing with when they just played with 10 men, can I say, over the weekend when, you know, Sampdoria were, and I just a quick mention on that, I thought both Sampdoria and Genoa had really bad games over the weekend. I don't know whether or not it was by looking forward to the derby that they were facing, which was technically hideous as well to watch. I fell asleep in the extended highlights. In the highlights, I could barely
see. You used the word hideous twice today.
I mean, it's just insane. But yeah, I just thought, like, I have to say, when it comes to Gasperini, is there a better coach?
Is he like he's the anti-Funte, I think, because he's someone who seems like he's so good fun, but there's actually that other side to Gasperini where he can be a bit harsh and a bit moody. And we've heard shades of that from players.
From ex-players, but whether it's Papu Gomez or Timothy Castagne, there's been reports that Gasperini's a little firecracker behind the scenes.
Then he had that bust up with the Roma backroom stuff.
Yeah, Mihailovic, let's not forget that back and forth slinging of insults.
Love it. But they played against Crotone as well. They absolutely thrashed them. And there's been another coaching change since we were last on. Cosmi came in as the new coach until the end of the season. Didn't start out well enough for him. Go on then.
Can I just say, Cersei Cosmi, the first thing that's reminded of me, and you can all go look online, I have no idea if this is verified, but this was a report coming from one of the Italian outlets that ages ago, more than a decade ago, to lift the morale of his team, I believe it was Genoa at the time, he started showing a pornographic film on the bus. Has anyone heard of this? You can go look up
Cersei
Cosmi pornography and you'll see that article again.
Be careful what you're putting into Google here.
No, exactly.
Are you sure that's not a joke?
Maybe say Cersei Cosmi team talk.
It's there. I can't verify it, but it is there. And it was brought to my attention on Twitter. I had vaguely remembered it, but I kind of brushed it off like a rumor. But apparently something like this happened where he showed some sort of explicit video on the team bus to try to lift morale. And I did not search what the contents were of that video, but I don't know if I'm glad or if I'm worried that Cersei Cosmi's back in Serie A. I always feel like he's the guy who takes control.
If he did it before this game, it didn't work.
He is Antonio Conte without the success or the fun. Like, that's how I would describe Cersei Cosmi. Like, that guy is, if you want to talk a lot, he is a lot.
Why did he even get a job? Like, I don't understand. Who would... Look, I get Stroppa, like, has been, you know, like, hasn't had the... Firstly, can I just say, like, I really do like the way that Crotone play football. I think they're hideous at the back. This is the fourth time I've used this word, yeah? I think they are very horrendous. Let's try that. They are very bad at the back, and they have, as soon as they lose something, you know, concede one goal, they play really good first half sometimes. But as soon as they concede one goal, it's like they just psychologically fall apart and thought, well, you know, sod this. We might as well just lose the whole thing, you know? And they do have a bad, you know, psychology. In terms of how the game has developed, I thought, you know, Stroppa has been with them for a while. He's really worked hard with these players. But there comes a point where you have to understand, like, this is why I get so angry sometimes with Roma and Fonseca. Like, what do you think is going to happen? Like, it was always going to be hard for you to survive this. Like, you sacking a coach and bringing up, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to overcome and reach mid-level table or avoid the relegation? You have a side that's one of the smallest budgets, if not the actual smallest budget in the league. So what did you think was it? you're going to get relegated whoever you sack. So just stay with Stroppen. Don't pay in someone else, honestly.
I don't have a problem with changing manager if you're doing it for a reason, right? Like, I find the, like, this choice, I find Cosmi such a, like, dispiriting choice. Not even for Matteo's reasons, which are clearly very colourful and worth investigating, maybe on incognito mode.
But just be careful
mode.
How
I
you
don't
investigate.
Know.
Incognito mode!
But I just, look, this guy has been bouncing teams down from Serie A for most of his career. He's not an awful manager, but he's not we've got 15 games to save the season manager, because he's not done that if he has
well,
for a
he
very
did it
long
once
time.
And now there's this reputation of if you need to be lifted ago. Out of the relegation, Cesc calls him as your guy, and then he relegated like five teams and teams still don't get the clue.
But this is the important bit. For me, that's gonna set me off. Leonardo Semplici, who Cagliari have gone out and appointed, is a manager who's got some upside, who's going somewhere. And look what happens. You hire him, you win your first two games in charge. Davide Nicola, who we talked about before at Torino, hasn't lost a game yet at Torino. He's got a bit more to go through.
Nikki, it's almost like the team with the statistically worst defense in history doesn't know what they're doing. It's weird.
And just a quick mention before we do go, Lazio did play one game, obviously not the game against Torino, and they lost it to Bologna. And this is actually props to Bologna, because it was the first time they've beaten a top of the table side this season. Mina's losing it, actually, and understandably so after that last topic. Anyway, Inzaghi said he's worried about the reaction from his Lazio side to negative incidents. I'm sure that's something we can revisit when they actually do play. Just be careful how you do go and look up anything to do with Cosmi. Don't blame us here on the Serie A.
I think that's
awesome.
What Mina did. That's why she's lost it.
That's why she's laughing. Before this gets any worse and goes any further,
I downloaded a virus on her computer.
I'm going to say thanks so much for listening. We'll be back at the usual time next